Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always a pleasure to be able to welcome to our microphones to assess the state of the war for the free world one of the most perspicacious and accomplished national security reporters of, I think, not only our time, but any time. He is Bill Gertz, senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, an invaluable online resource, as well as the prize-winning columnist of the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times, the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently I, War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Always good to be on the show.
We have had some big developments that you have been reporting on, notably out of North Korea, since we last talked, Bill. Let's visit a little bit about what we now know about not only their missile program, but also their nuclear weapons program, and in particular, the threat that it may pose to us in the form of something called electromagnetic pulse, EMP.
Yes, the latest and sixth North Korean underground nuclear test was the largest to date, and the U.S. intelligence community is still assessing what type of explosive it was. The three options are that it was a thermonuclear hydrogen explosion, that is a very large blast. Another possibility is that it was some type of an electromagnetic pulse weapon. And then the third is that it was something called a boosted fission explosion. And of course, the eyebrows went up on a lot of people when the North Koreans announced on Sunday that they plan to use this new large nuclear weapon for EMP attacks. That is a burst in space that could severely damage or destroy electronics over wide areas. And then the following day, on Monday, the state-run Communist Party newspaper in Pyongyang reported by the dean of a technical university who elaborated on the EMP threat and called EMP an important strike weapon. This, again, as you may know, has been a subject of much debate. Many in the arms control community have downplayed this threat or even dismissed it. And a few people, like former CIA Director Jim Woolsey and Peter Pry and yourself and others, have been loudly saying, look, we've got to prepare for this. And now the North Koreans have finally mentioned that they are planning this type of an attack.
Well, this is interesting to me, not only, as you say, because of our longtime concern of this problem and that of our colleagues in the Secure the Grid Coalition, which includes, in addition to Jim Woolsey and Peter Pry, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, the comments of Siegfried Hecker, who you may remember from his days as the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Hank Cooper pointed out on our show yesterday, used to do important work for him, among others, when he was running the SDI program, to protect our assets against electromagnetic pulse. In this comments yesterday about this North Korean threat, he simply dismissed it, saying it was all just a function of alarmists from this country who were feeding into what's now a propaganda line there. What do you make of his remarks?
Well, it seems that a lot of people in the arms control community have, for some reason, dismiss this idea that our electrical grid is vulnerable. And it's amazing to me to see these kind of head-in-the-sand kind of comments from people like Hecker and others. Jeffrey Lewis is another one.
He's made kind of a career out of doing it. But Sig strikes me as a serious physicist, for God's sake. And this is just a matter of science, not, you know, political science.
The North Koreans are prone to propaganda, but they've also been doing what they say instead of just propaganda. And they've done that with their nuclear tests. If In fact, this was a hydrogen blast. It could be prepared for an EMP attack. And the reason that it's important is because most of the North Korean propaganda videos have shown simulated kinetic attacks, including videos on New York City and Washington in flames. So we know that that's their interest. But imagine if they did do a space-based EMP attack, which damaged and destroyed and caused havoc and chaos, it would also complicate our retaliation. There would be voices that would say, well, this is not a direct attack. And the allies would also say, is it worth starting a war over this? Anyway, obviously, it creates major complications for our deterrence credibility.
I fear at some level it may even preclude us from exercising that retaliatory action, even if the decision were clearly to be that we needed to do that. Let me ask you, speaking of space, Bill, to pivot to North Korea's prime sponsor, as you know and have documented in your columns, that being, of course, Communist China. You had a report this week about the extent to which China's efforts to militarize space by having very considerable capabilities, both in space and through it, to neutralize our own activities there. This is a serious and yawning national security challenge, it would appear. Is that right?
Yeah, this was a report that I wrote about in my Washington Times Inside the Ring column this week. And it's based on a new report on foreign space capabilities and the national security implications. And it, too, pointed out that our satellites are extremely vulnerable to that kind of an attack. Not just EMP, but other types of attacks like lasers and direct ascent missiles. And of course, adversaries like China and Russia and North Korea and Iran understand that this is a strategic vulnerability for the United States. And any future conflict, according to this report, is going to involve major attacks on our satellites and to shut down the communications, to shut down the precision guidance. So this is a really, really significant disclosure. And finally, at least this think tank is highlighting this growing threat.
It is a growing threat, and it's one that we all best be concerned about, especially if you believe, as I do, that we need missile defenses in space if we're going to deal with some of the emerging capabilities, not just of the North Koreans, or for that matter, just the Chinese, but the Russians, Iranians, and others as well. Let me quickly ask you about two issues that fall in the battle space you've written about in your new book, iWar: Russian Twitter bots and a Chinese malicious software called Sakula. What can you tell us about those?
This is an important story. NATO, for the first time, issued a recent report which highlights the fact that most Russian language tweets in Eastern Europe are automated and from automated bots, which the Russian government is controlling as part of its information warfare against NATO and against the West. And it was significant because it was one of the first times that they've actually come out and highlighted this growing threat, that the Russians are using all means possible, short of military conflict, or in the case of Ukraine, actual military conflict, to undermine support for NATO and to divide and try and conquer the NATO alliance. I would also point out I had a very significant story today in the Free Beacon, which involves Chinese hacking of a yacht owned by a billionaire dissident in New York. The FBI is investigating the fact that it appears that the Chinese were using electronic warfare means to disable a 152-foot yacht in New York Harbor and almost caused a collision between a natural gas tanker and this billionaire's boat. The billionaire is Guo Wengui, who has been outspoken in highlighting Chinese intelligence activities in the United States, and he believes firmly that Chinese intelligence was behind this cyber attack on his yacht. It took place in late July.
Man, and that would have been a liquefied natural gas tanker?
Yes.
That would have caused the equivalent of a small thermonuclear weapon.
Yes. Yeah. And it was right under the George Washington Bridge.
This is an extraordinary story, Bill Gertz. We're going to have you back to discuss it at much greater length next week. Thank you for all that you do, my friend, at the Washington Free Beacon, the Washington Times. Bill Gertz's reporting is not to be missed, folks. I hope you'll check it out. Bill, thank you. Have a good weekend. We'll talk with you next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Michael Del Rosso with a firsthand account of what happened in Charlottesville and what is happening in its aftermath. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by an old friend and much admired colleague, a member of the Senior Fellows of the Center for Security Policy, as well as the Vice President and Senior Fellow of a new organization established by Brian Kennedy and Bill Bennett called the American Strategy Group. He is Michael Del Rosso, an accomplished electrical engineer, as well as a vastly impressive strategic analyst, therefore a go-to guy on several things we're interested in talking with him about, most especially Charlottesville, a place that he happened to be on a momentous day recently, and here to talk about it, I'm very pleased to say, is Michael, both, I hope, on the basis of what you saw on the occasion of a riot there, Michael, over ostensibly a Confederate statue, and your insights as to where it has left us. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you.
Great to be back, Frank. Thank you.
Tell us about your experiences, Michael, on the occasion, and as I said, where we are now.
I've lived in Charlottesville for 11 years, and I'm politically active. In fact, I ran for the Virginia 5th District just this last 2016 election cycle in the convention that we had. This is par for the course. Charlottesville, you know, it's tragic those two troopers died and that young woman, okay? But it was not only so misreported, but the other events had preceded it. So, for instance, on July 8th, I was also out for a rally that the Ku Klux Klan had staged.
Now, just for the record, this is not because you are a member of the Ku Klux Klan or a white supremacist or anything else.
I don't hate anyone. You know why I went out? They interviewed the organizer in the local Seville Weekly. The reporter goes, "So you hate people?" And he goes, "I don't hate anyone. I don't hate blacks. I don't hate Jews." He goes, "Well, I hate Jews." So I went out. I put my yarmulke on as a sign of solidarity to any jerk that would dare actually say he's a hater. And they did. But the point I'm making, though, is there was about a couple of dozen Klan guys that I never even got to see. But there was at least 1,000 people countering it, including large sections of Antifa. And the police got the Klan in and out, and they departed town, but the Antifa guys wouldn't disperse, and they fired tear gas on them. They had a massive presence. And so, and if you actually listen to the rhetoric, I mean, I have recordings, you know, you have the World Workers Party, Antifa. They are calling for the violent overthrow of the U.S. government and the replacement of it with the communist regime.
Now, this was at the first event, and then you were there for the second event as well.
Both events. It's both events. This is what they call for. So you see that frequently, and there's no one coming to shout them down. But they came. Look, the second event, they came for violence. And it's a travesty what happened. Let me just summarize it this way. We knew a travesty was going to happen because all the intelligence said so. Not only was the governor and the mayor and the vice mayor told of this, but the president of the United States was getting into his briefing package. Now, here, the president's a man that he's dealing with perhaps an imminent nuclear war. Yet this was going to be so obvious, the indications and warning that violence would happen. And yet the political authorities that ran the entire show. So the state police showed up and they were subordinated to the Charlottesville Police Department, whether through maliciousness or incompetence, they failed crowd and riot control 101. So the Charlottesville police showed up without riot gear. They were ordered not to wear it. The Charlottesville police then couldn't respond when things got ugly. And the crowds were deliberately dispersed, opposing crowds into each other. The streets weren't blocked off. You know, 101 crowd control is you block streets and for vehicle entry and exit, because if you have a large crowd assembled, in this case, it was an illegal crowd, the Antifa ones, You don't want any vehicles going into them.
Okay. So, Michael, let me just ask you, a lot of the heat that was generated by this event, of course, was in the aftermath of it. And in particular, President Trump's characterization of what went down as a function of two sets of bad actors. He was vilified for pointing out that this Antifa group and its knockoffs and partners in crime, literally, were also deplorable individuals and engaged in misbehavior of a violent kind. From the vantage point of a person on the ground, an objective observer, was there anything wrong with what he said? And why was he so vilified for it?
His first remarks, I listened to. They came out before we even knew the details of the guy, the homicide guy in the car that killed the young woman. And then his remarks on Monday, where he expounded on it, were even more spot on. And I was saddened. The whole Virginia Republican congressional delegation threw the president under the bus or ignored it. It's probably the lowest possible rung of a ladder to be able to denounce Nazis, the Klan, and white supremacists. That doesn't take a lot of moral courage. And that's as far as most of these guys went. Some of them, like even my own Congressman Tom Garrett, said he commended the mayor and the governor. I still don't know what for. And he had an opportunity to defend the president, and he said, I'm not the president's speechwriter.
So, but just from your perspective, the president had it right. And I think the most important takeaway from this, for me at least, is this was really an exercise, whether it was provocation from the get-go or not, I think we could discuss, but at the very least, it was an exercise in trying to suppress freedom of speech by the hard left, and it seems as though it has been monstrously successful. And we'll have a hearing next Tuesday in the House Homeland Security Committee. I've just been talking to some of its members. There's a real concern that this throwing under the bus, as you put it, is going to continue. I hope not, because people need to understand this is a struggle for our First Amendment freedoms, and the president's right on this, and I think needs to be supported in his comments. Let me ask you, Michael, quickly to turn to one other topic in which you're also expert, and that is this question of electromagnetic pulse. I know you have, as a member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, been pursuing very assiduously the threat that this kind of phenomenon, naturally occurring or man-caused, represents to our electric grid. We've had, and I was just talking with Bill Gertz about it, a former director of Los Alamos National Laboratory, Siegfried Hecker, dismiss this phenomenon and suggest that it's nothing but alarmists who have raised concerns about it. What's your professional judgment on that question?
Look, so I was past chairman of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Committee for the IEEE. I participated in the classified EMP Commission hearings a decade ago. And there's been not just the EMP Commission reports, but five Blue Ring commissions have all looked at this problem and said it's a serious existential threat, because it gets down to two questions. Are the consequences of an EMP attack serious and potentially sovereignty ending? And the answer is yes. And then is the probability of it occurring serious, a high probability? And the answer is yes. So for 55 years, the military has hardened the most critical nuclear command and control systems because it's a real threat. There's people that want to poo-poo it, but they don't ever come back and say why. So if you challenge them and say, well, and it's not just the Los Alamos guy. There's people that are former senior officials like in Lawrence Livermore Labs or the Defense Nuclear Agency that said it's not a big deal, but they don't have anything to back it up. And the signal, the tests that were conducted, because, you know, it wasn't a lot of money, but there was several millions of dollars spent testing weapons effects and such by just the commission, and then the military tested it well, say that it's exactly such a threat.
Michael Del Rosso, We have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say there is so much more to talk with you about, but we look forward to doing so again soon. I appreciate your time today and the work that you have been doing with us at the Center for Security Policy, and congratulations on the new gig with Bill Bennett and the fabulous Brian Kennedy at the American Strategy Group. Come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we'll talk with Rowan Scarborough, about developments in Iraq and what the implications are of our failing to understand the threat posed by Iran, there and beyond. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, it's a pleasure to say, joined by Rowan Scarborough, another superb national security reporter who, alongside his comrade and colleague and pal of ours, Bill Gertz, has been doing extraordinarily important reporting work in the national security arena and a 26-year career at the Washington Times. Rowan is, among other things, the author of two terrific books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage. Rowan Scarborough, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm anxious to talk with you about some of the things you've been reporting on, Rowan, that aren't getting, as far as I'm concerned, nearly the attention they deserve, despite your best efforts and ours. Specifically, what's been developing in Iraq as it relates to the rising influence, pretty much dominance of the place by the Iranians? You had a fascinating and really quite chilling report about some of the militias that are Iranian-backed turning on the United States forces there once they settle accounts with the Islamic State. Talk a little bit about what you found and how worrying this is as perhaps a microcosm of a larger problem with Iran.
Sure. Go back to 2007 during the famous Iraq troop surge. Iran tried to counter that by organizing a number of extremist Shiite militias. They trained them. They took some of them into Iran, brought them back in, and they were able to kill at least 500 American troops using hidden bombs and rocketry that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Quds Force equipped. So they didn't go away. 10 years later, those militias are still active in Iraq. They have a new mission, and that is, number one, to kill Sunni ISIL members who tried to take over Iraq. That's sort of good. You can look at it that way. But then number two, they announced over the weekend, the most vicious of these militias, the Hezbollah brigades, that once the last ISIL or the last ISIL unit is out of Iraq, they're going to turn their weapons on us, on Americans. And I think the history of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is that they do what they say. They're very brazen. They'll take on our ships. They'll invade Syria. And so if they say they're going to do this, they're going to do it.
Well, it is indeed. And I think it's part of a larger and still more troubling problem of what Iran is up to, let's be honest, emboldened and certainly enabled by the immense amount of money that the Obama administration saw fit to transfer to Tehran as part of this, I call it the Obama bomb deal. Rowan, as you look at what's playing out here, they're perfectly prepared to collaborate with us in destroying their Sunni opponents, but they will turn on us as part of Iran's larger agenda. Some have called it this Shiite crescent that they're trying to carve out, not just in Iraq, but also in Syria and, of course, Lebanon, which through Hezbollah they've dominated for a long time. Is that basically the plan that we're seeing play out here? And what would you be counseling the United States do about it, given that we've got forces on the ground at the moment who are going to be in considerable jeopardy shortly?
Well, Frank, that's exactly what Iran is doing. They want hegemony from Tehran all the way to Beirut, going through Iraq and Syria. That's their ultimate goal. And to get us out is a corollary goal. So there's only one country that can stop them from doing this, and we haven't done a very good job so far, and that is American troops in Syria and American troops in Iraq. And that's why they're threatening to kill us, because they want us out. The answer to this is to make sure that the Abadi government, I know there's an election coming up in Iraq, but to make sure that it is a top priority of this government not to placate the Hezbollah brigade in Iran, and that to become more independent and realize that American troops have to defend themselves if you want us to stay there. I think those are the two overriding goals that our State Department has to make sure Baghdad does not do what Tehran wants them to do, but does what Washington wants them to do.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's a losing bet, to be honest with you, Rowan. There are those who argue that what we should really be about now is just watching what's happening already be formalized, namely break up Iraq and have such U.S. forces as are going to be there, mostly, if not exclusively, located in the Kurdish areas, perhaps in some of the Sunni areas as well, but steer clear of what is going to be, I'm afraid, increasingly a proxy for Iran in the Shiite-controlled areas, including, of course, Baghdad. Let me ask you about a related issue you've also reported on, Rowan Scarborough, at the Washington Times, namely how badly the Iranian regime is treating those who've had the courage to be dissidents in that country. They've been known for their ruthlessness, their brutality. What's the latest on that front?
Well, the dissidents, again, are trying to speak out in Iran. Iran has killed thousands of dissidents, principally by hanging and other modes of execution. In 1988, I think the UN has established that they likely killed almost 40,000 dissidents in 1 year. Well, they housed them in one particular notorious prison where the conditions have gotten so bad that 20 or 30 dissidents have gone on a hunger strike. And that's been greeted with a brutal retaliation where they basically put them in hell holes in another part of the prison where they can barely exist. And even the United Nations put out a statement a couple of years ago calling on Iran to come back to some more humane reality when it comes to, if you're going to arrest people for their political beliefs, at least treat them in a humane manner. And the UN has also, in August, came out with its latest report on human rights in Iran, and they have not gotten any better. It's a very, very harsh report on what Iran is doing to dissidents and its people, despite, you know, the nuclear deal, which we thought would turn the ship of state a little bit in Iran, but it has not.
I don't know who thought that. I certainly didn't. I doubt you did, Rowan Scarborough, but I know that was the official U.S. government line at the time. It seemed preposterous then, and it certainly isn't playing out now, except in the way that many of us expected, which is we've actually emboldened the mullahs in Iran to think that they can brutalize their own people and threaten ours with impunity, alas. Let me ask you about one other issue here at home, Rowan. You turned your sights on an issue we'll be talking more about shortly with Hans von Spakovsky, one of the members of the president's voting fraud commission. I wonder what you have made of the insights you've shared with all of us about a very close vote in New Hampshire, which it seems was in fact decided, a United States Senate seat, on the basis of electoral fraud. Tell us about it.
And, you know, Republicans say for years that Massachusetts voters take advantage of New Hampshire's same-day registration vote rules that just come across state lines with very little ID, no proof of where they live, and vote. And we know from Project Veritas in February, they actually had poll workers on camera saying, well, just vote and leave the state then. That's the advice that they were giving people who had no identification, and then they were allowed to vote. Well, the House Speaker in New Hampshire, a Republican, asked for some data on just one little nugget. How many people voted on Election Day, registered and voted on Election Day with out-of-state driver's licenses, and then how many of them went on to get a state license as they're required to do? About 3% did. Frank, 3%. So is that absolute evidence of fraud? No. But is it an indication that people came from out of state to vote that day but had no intention of ever residing in New Hampshire? I think it is, yes.
Indeed. And as I recall, it changed perhaps that Senate seat from the Republicans to the Democrats, if assuming, as I think we can reasonably do, those folks from Massachusetts were not coming across to vote Republican. Rowan, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Your reporting, as always, is extraordinarily important and much valued by us. We appreciate the time you give us to talk about it again, now and again. We look forward to doing that with you very soon. In the meantime, keep it up at the Washington Times, my friend. And folks, check out his two books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage, required reading. Thank you, Rowan. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Hans von Spakovsky on electoral fraud and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. In the House, virtually at least, is our friend and go-to guy on matters involving, well, so many issues concerning the law and specifically immigration. He is Hans von Spakovsky. He is these days the senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He has been in government in a number of capacities, including as a member of the Federal Election Commission. These days, he is serving on President Trump's Election Integrity Commission, trying to understand and help the rest of us get clarity about the extent to which there is electoral fraud in this country and whether it is affecting elections. He is the author of, among other things, two books, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk with John Fund, and Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. Welcome back, Hans. It's so good to have you.
Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Much to cover in a little bit of time, so let me be quick about it. I was just talking with Rowan Scarborough about some reporting that he's done on a report out of the House Speaker's office in New Hampshire, suggesting that there has indeed been not only voter fraud in that state, but very consequential voter fraud at that. What light can you shed on that, if you would, please?
Well, what happened was New Hampshire has same-day registration. In other words, you can show up on Election Day, register to vote, and vote. And apparently, in the November election, when Hillary Clinton only won the state by 3,000 votes, more than 6,000 people showed up in New Hampshire using out-of-state driver's licenses to register to vote. So the Speaker of the House asked the state to tell him, of those individuals, how many of them have now gotten New Hampshire driver's licenses, because there's a law in New Hampshire, you know, once you establish residency there within 60 days, you've got to switch to a New Hampshire driver's license. Well, it turns out, only about 15%, only about 1,000 people out of the over 6,000 actually got a New Hampshire driver's license. Of those remaining, only about 3% of them actually also have a car registered in New Hampshire. So we have the potential here of, 5,000 individuals who may have come up, particularly from Massachusetts, just to register for the day so they could vote. How many of them also voted in Massachusetts? Well, we don't know that yet, but there's a potential here that, in essence, fraud decided the state and also the Senate, the U.S. Senate race, which was very close.
For all these reasons, there has been an effort in a number of states, and you have been one of the champions of this cause, to have real voter IDs and other necessary protections against voter fraud. The state of Texas is one of those places. It has recently had an effort made to strip out its voter ID statutes that has now, I guess, been countermanded. Give us the latest on that, if you would, Hans von Spakovsky.
Yeah, that case has a long, complex procedural history. But in essence, about 2 weeks ago, a federal district court judge down in Texas, an Obama appointee, for the fifth time, if you can believe that, tossed out Texas's latest amended version of its ID law. Texas immediately appealed to the Fifth Circuit. The Court of Appeals issued a stay. That means they, in essence,
reversed what the lower court had done while the case is pending in the appeals court. What that means is that the voter ID law is back in place and will be effective in the state elections that Texas is having in November.
Interesting. There's another example of judicial interference in Texas. Tell me about, Hans, this judge in San Antonio who has struck down the Sanctuary Cities bill that was adopted, I believe, earlier this year by the state legislature.
Yeah, the Texas legislature wanted to stop sanctuary cities in Texas. There are a number of them, like Austin. And so they passed a bill that, in essence, said any town or county that puts in sanctuary policies is going to have to pay civil penalties for doing that. And law enforcement officials who engage in that kind of behavior and, for example, refuse to turn over criminal illegal aliens to immigration authorities, the Attorney General of Texas can actually go to court and have that sheriff removed from office. A federal district court judge enjoined or stopped provisions of this law from going in place. It's frankly a bizarre opinion. It's another one of these activist judges making all kinds of claims that just really have no basis in the law. So it's been temporarily enjoined, but again, Texas is also appealing that decision, and hopefully it'll get overturned in the higher courts.
Indeed. But again, in all of these cases, it really speaks to the enforcement of the law, doesn't it? And the necessity of enforcing the law, whether it's with respect to voting, you know, integrity or immigration or the like. Speaking of immigration, ask you for your opinion. Hans von Spakovsky, among other things, you served in senior positions in the Justice Department as well. What did you make of the president's decision on this deferred action on childhood arrivals, DACA?
Well, he did the right thing. You know, all these critics have been talking about whether DACA was a good policy or a bad policy, but that's really irrelevant to the situation. Why? Well, because when Barack Obama put this program in 2012, which in essence provided amnesty and access to government benefits to this particular group of illegal aliens, he was doing so without any authority to do it. He doesn't have the constitutional power to basically provide amnesty for illegal aliens. Only Congress can do that. And so President Trump is, you know, he says he's actually doing a 6-month wind down of this and said, look, if Congress thinks this is a good idea, it's up to them to do it. And he's absolutely right about that. Now, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think Congress should do it. But the president acted appropriately because this is a legislative issue. It should be decided in the halls of Congress, not the White House.
I tend to agree with that. But I do wonder about his subsequent tweet to the effect that he would revisit the whole business if Congress did not act within the 6 months. Did you read that as trying to establish a constitutional power that he doesn't have and that he actually decried when Obama exercised?
Yeah, I guess you could read it that way. I'm not quite sure what to make of that. I think right now he's acted in the correct constitutional manner, in a manner guaranteed to try to bring back the rule of law, which is so important. And hopefully, if Congress fails to act in 6 months, he won't take any action to try to reinstate this.
Well, let's hope so. Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Hans von Spakovsky. You have written about a comment that Attorney General Jeff Sessions made in the course of presenting the president's decision on DACA, in which he used the term illegal alien. And Andrea Mitchell of NBC, notably, I believe, on MSNBC, the full-time anti-Trump channel, took strong exception to that term. You say, no, it's actually legally correct. What is it?
Yeah, Andrea Mitchell shouldn't try to play a lawyer on TV because she said that what he said was offensive and that the use of that term was not correct. Well, in fact, she's wrong. I can come up with a string of citations to U.S. Supreme Court cases involving immigration issues where the justices of the Supreme Court constantly and repeatedly use the term illegal aliens. That is the correct legal term, even though these days it's the politically incorrect term to use, as Andrea Mitchell seems to think.
I think clarity, specifically on the point that it is illegal, especially important. You get that, needless to say. Hans von Spakovsky, thank you for helping the rest of us do so as well. We appreciate the work you do at the Heritage Foundation tremendously, and wish you the best of luck, you and your colleagues, on the President's Commission on Election Integrity. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.